Good evening, everyone, and thank you for listening to the Futurati podcast, where we dive into how emerging technologies will impact the world and your bank account. I'm Trent Fowler, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Thomas Fry. Thomas and I are futurists, keynote speakers, and consultants with decades of experience in analyzing trends and communicating new developments to audiences across the world. Reach out to us at futuratipodcast.com/contact-futurati if you'd like to hire us for consulting, to speak at your event, or to advertise on our podcast. Now, Thomas, we just wrapped up one of the more interesting interviews we've done here with Johannes Jaeger, who is a biologist and a sort of philosopher of biology who's turned his attention towards artificial intelligence and has come up with a really fascinating critique of the predominant views around artificial intelligence and whether or not specifically we could scale up something like a large language model. If it was large enough, if the first L were big enough, you'd have an agent, you'd have a general intelligence, and it might wreck the world. He says, no, that's not the case. And in fact, there are important ways in which natural intelligences like us are just architecturally different from anything we're building currently. And we don't really have much to fear from them at present, at least not existentially. There are other concerns around deepfakes and some of those sorts of things. What did you think about the conversation?
Oh, I thought he was brilliant. I feel good that I'm not going to get buried in paper clips. That's good.
Not enough paper clips around here. I don't need any more paper clips.
Yeah, this thinking that we're going to reach a plateau with artificial intelligence, that's interesting. That's the first time I've ever heard that. This is, I think, one of the more salient, the crisp and clean ways of describing this. He has a great way of articulating the whole issue, the whole problem, and coming to his conclusion. So I thought he was absolutely brilliant.
I agree. I've had a lot of these conversations with philosophers and different sorts of folks who have a really strong intuition that there's something about us that's different, that we're alive in a way an algorithm isn't, and that matters somehow. But I haven't met too many people who can actually make a particularly rigorous case from start to finish that encompasses, you know, bacteria and us and all of life, and also rules out the possibility of an algorithmic superintelligence. So it was really, really good to find this work and to dive into it and to talk to him.
Yeah. Quite refreshing, indeed.
Yeah, absolutely. So we hope that you are refreshed as well by this interview with Johannes Jaeger. Tonight, we're joined by Dr. Johannes Jaeger. Johannes is a systems scientist, evolutionary biologist, educator, and natural philosopher with an extremely transdisciplinary track record. His investigations, first as the head of an empirical lab, later as the director of an institute for the philosophy of biology, and then as a freelance investigator, have always focused on organisms as complex adaptive systems. He is currently leading a research project at the Department of Philosophy of the University of Vienna called Pushing the Boundaries, which concerns the difference between machines and organisms and the importance of this difference for evolution. He is associate faculty at the Complexity Science Hub in Vienna and a scholar at the Ronin Institute. If you enjoyed this interview, please subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends. And don't forget to check out our website, futuratipodcast.com. Dr. Jaeger, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Trent and Thomas, for having me.
Let's hear a little bit about your background, your interests, and what brought you to working on the projects that you're working on today.
So yeah, that's a long story that I have to cut short. Is I started out as an experimental biologist, so I'm an evolutionary biologist, and I increasingly got interested in conceptual ideas, which sort of pushed me into this corner of talking about all these words that we use in AI research that are actually coming out of biology. Originally, right? And so I think it's really interesting that there's very little biology heard in that whole debate. So I come to this topic through the study of organisms, how they are organized, and I'm an evolutionary biologist. So I usually, when I'm not debating about AI, I study how the structure, the organization of organisms influences evolution, actually. So that's what I do during the day.
Well, I find that fascinating. We're probably going to have to stick to AI today. But yeah, I mean, I'd be interested in all the rest of it as well. So I just wanted to say at the outset that I've been having these debates for a long time now, and I have long suspected that something from the philosophy of biology would be useful in getting purchase on some of the underlying concepts, specifically intelligence, agency, and consciousness are all things that we use in we seem to use them in a very haphazard way. And even among people who I consider very, very careful in their thinking, I notice there's a tendency to kind of like slide between them all and just sort of use them in a way that does not facilitate getting really serious about it. So you are, to the best of my knowledge so far in 10 years of having these arguments, the first person to have written a really substantive and rigorous critique of the underlying ideas that, so I believe personally in a very strong version of substrate independence, but you have got very clever architectural arguments about why ultimately what it is that we're doing as living things is not, it cannot be reduced solely to algorithms. And so we're not just going to run like a big enough model and get like AGI just kind of fall out of it on the other side. So I really appreciate that, just to start.
Thank you.
So why don't we just get right into it? You, across a couple of papers, and I've got one here called Artificial Intelligence as Algorithmic Mimicry, you make the case that there are certain properties arising from the way organisms, biological entities like ourselves, are structured, which mean that they cannot be reducible to an algorithm. And even if an LLM approximates some of what we do, it's not ultimately algorithmic in the relevant senses. So if you want to just start there, talking about autopoiesis, embodiment, and the large world hypothesis, I think that'd be a great place for us to get going.
Yeah, great. So I think the main distinction to be made is that organisms obviously self-manufacture. So they not only make all the parts that they're composed of, but they're also putting those together in a way that makes them functional, which is something that I'm on the fence in terms of substrate independence, but I would say my arguments are about where we are right now with our technology. And this is not how we build machines, not even our most sophisticated, hardware, computer hardware is actually built by the software that's running on it. So that's a completely different design. So self-manufacture is a causal regime. So it's a way of having causality go around in circles, but it's not just feedback. Feedback is a process that is sort of regulating itself. But here we have processes, different processes at different time scales and spatial scales very often that interact with each other and construct each other. So is this a computational process? Well, it isn't in the sense that it doesn't alt. The whole purpose of life and evolution is to try avoid halting. That's pretty obvious for a biologist. And the other thing is that this co-constructive dynamic, that one process is not just feeding back on the other, but they construct each other, makes them very unusual and very, very different, of course, from any sort of computational or algorithmic construct that we've built so far. So that's the first point. The second point that is hugely neglected, but really important, is embodiment. And embodiment here in particular means that the von Neumann machines that we've built based on the Turing machine model that are computers today are have a strict separation of hardware and software because they're designed to run as many different algorithms as we can possibly run on a piece of hardware. So you want to have software and hardware independent of each other. While if you can talk about hardware and software at all in a living system, you maybe can say that the genes are the software. The genome is being read by the cell. Those genes are read out and they make proteins that are the components of the cell itself. So basically the enzymes that transcribe those genes are made from the genes. So there is the hardware is the software, is the hardware is the software. It's the same thing. So that's one thing. The other thing is then once you have a living cell or a multicellular organism with a brain, it interacts with the world in a very different way from a machine. If you put software in a robot, it still goes through a layer of hardware. Effectors and sensors, and those are not constructed by the software, obviously itself. So it's sort of one step removed from its experience, let's say, while you are right in your world, right? And why is that important? That's the third factor that I describe in that paper, is that makes us live in a large world. And that doesn't mean it's big spatially, but it means that a lot of the problems and phenomena that we encounter in this world are not well-defined. So we need to pick out what is relevant for us. And that, you know, requires a point of view on the world and define our problems before we can solve them. While an algorithm exists in a small world, which can be huge, the world of chess, if you think about it, is astronomically huge, all the possible moves that you can make. But it's a small world because every move is well-defined by the rules of the game. So basically, a small world is a world, these are terms invented by Leonard Savage in the 1950s. The small world is not physically small or combinatorially small, but it has all the problems well-defined. And an algorithm, even the most complicated LLM at the moment, lives in an environment that is completely determined by the hardware architecture, the coding environment, and its own code in a way. So all it can see, and also, of course, by the data and the way it's been annotated and everything. So it lives in a small world, even the most complicated algorithm that we've designed so far. So it has a very different way of experiencing its world because it has no limited point of view like we do. But it is seeing, in a way, its entire world at once. So there's nothing that's ill-defined or unknown in that world. And I think these differences are really, really crucial when we think about, you know, what does it mean to have general intelligence? And again, what I did in this paper and earlier on is use a definition of general intelligence that comes from biology that involves things like dealing with ambiguity and, most importantly, I think, reframing problems. You know, humans can reframe a problem, but ultimately, no matter how indirectly you frame problems in computer science, even in those very complicated algorithmic systems that we've built, the problems are always already framed. There is one fixed frame that is given to begin with. And I think these differences really matter. That's the point I'm trying to make.
So let me ask if this is similar to what you're talking about. If I walk into a room, subconsciously, I will put an emotional value on all the things that I see in that room, whether it's a couch or a table or a lamp, and like the couch will be worth more than the lamp and worth more than the table. And so these emotional values then give me a way of kind of judging how the room is set up and things like that. Is that's something that I don't see AI having the ability to do, this emotional feel part of it. Is that
correct? So this is, yeah, that's extremely important. And you put it really well. So you have, this is what it means to have a point of view. That means that you're, if you're a self-manufacturing organism, you're first of all responsible for your own, what you are, for your own identity. You're building that to a certain degree. It interacts with the environment, but then you also have a certain control over how you interact with the environment. You control your own boundaries. You control the interactions between the outside world and yourself to a certain degree. And so you have a motivated reasoning about the world, which gives you what we would call sense-making or meaning-making in the first place. And there are all these discussions about LLMs having semantic models of the world and all that, and whether you can read those out of the correlations, the statistics in a data set. And that's a different, you see, here we are at one of those concepts that are just used in a different way, because the kind of semantics that you get out of an abstraction of correlations in a training data set are completely different than the value-laden, you know, kind of reasoning that you bring in. And this is, I want to mention Joseph Weizenbaum early on in our conversation, what he distinguished early in the 70s already as calculation versus judgment. So this is everything you do when you perceive the world is already loaded with judgment, because you are a limited living being and you need to persist. You need to do physical work to stay alive. And so everything you perceive is already motivated based on the aim of staying alive. That's the foundational aim. But then you have all kinds of other goals that you set yourself, and you can set those because you have this very peculiar self-manufacturing organization. It's called autopoietic. And so this is very different from how we build machines, because machines are assembled. They have a function and a purpose too, but that purpose doesn't come from within. They're not self-driven in the same way and not motivated in the same way. And it seems to me very mysterious how you would put such self-motivation that is not just a simulation of behavior that looks as if it is self-motivated into an algorithm, but actual self-motivation. So someone, I think it was Terence Deacon, once said, before we get agency in an algorithm, we have to make it suffer. And I have no idea how you would do that.
So if I poke myself in the arm with a pen or a scissors, that hurts. If I go and work out, my muscles ache. These are things that AI can't relate to.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so this is a different kind of intelligence. But my question to you is, can it fake it? Can it come up with some simulation of the aches and pains that we feel?
This is an extremely important distinction to make, because the criteria of how to judge whether a system is intelligent or not differ also widely between the AI community and someone like me from biology, because starting with the Turing test, and I think Alan Turing was really ambiguous about it once he published it, there is this idea that if it quacks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, it's a duck. And it's so in this sense, I have no doubt that we're going to be successful in creating systems that act as if they were living beings. But the problem is, that's why I call it algorithmic mimicry. This is not real. And so then I immediately get accused of having metaphysical views that, you know, and nothing else. So I want to make a stand here that is not just a metaphysical view. It's actually a biological view that is scientifically backed up. We do know how organisms behave, and that they behave differently. And also from work of Dreyfus and Weizenbaum and others, we know that there's a difference between calculation, computation, and the value and meaning-laden sort of actions like judgment in living systems. So the task for me would not be to explain those away and say, okay, so if we can simulate that sort of behavior, if we can make an algorithm that writes you love poems if they loved you, we're happy with that, then that's the end of the discussion. But that is like the, you know, the Chinese room argument argued, not the real thing. That is not, we've not created life. We've not created an intelligence in that sense. And also the word agency is very dangerous, of course, because that's one of the words that means, and computational algorithmic agent means something completely different than an agent, an organismic agent. And I do upset sometimes AI researchers a bit when I say, I know a bacterium that can do something your best LLM cannot do. And that is, it cares. You know, it doesn't care like we do. It doesn't have a brain and thinks about and cares about things and worries about things, but it cares about its food. It goes for the food. It avoids the toxin. So it has a value system, if you want, a very simple one: good food, toxin bad, right? And yeah. I don't see any way in today's algorithmic architectures, no matter how complex, no matter how many billion parameters our models have, that we can get that kind of thing emerging from that architecture.
Hello, this is Trent Fowler, co-host of the Futurati podcast. One of the most common pieces of marketing advice I've come across is to know your audience and give them what they want. One difficulty in podcasting is that it's actually pretty hard to do this. None of the major platforms give us any way to reach out to you, our listeners, to find out what you enjoy about the Futurati podcast and what you'd like to see done differently. So we've decided to record this commercial and ask you directly to reach out to us. Head over to futuratipodcast.com, go to the contact page, and drop us a line. Tell us about your favorite and least favorite episodes, what you'd like to see us cover in the future, and anything else you want us to know. We produce this show for you, and we want your advice so we can make it even better. Thank you.
Okay, well, let's go down that argument. And if we start building robots that are we start adding flesh to the robots, we start growing tissue on the robots, then we start developing some of the same attributes that people have, because the flesh will feel heat, it will feel cold, it will feel pokes and lots of other things. And so I guess there's a point where it would seem like this robot has become cyborgish enough so it actually feels all the same things that humans do. And so do you get into the cyborgish arguments?
So we write at the end of one of the papers, I think it's the How Organism Comes to Know the World paper, that it's the AI paper. I say the AGI will come out of a biology lab. Okay. And I think it's a thing we should really think hard about. Is that a good thing? So if you think about the alignment problem, I think there are ways to deal with the alignment problem. I think it's harder to align the people who produce AI with the general public's interest at the moment than the algorithms themselves, to be honest. But that's because they're agents. You know, that is because they follow their own interests. that's why they're hard to align. While the engineering task of aligning algorithms, it's a complex task because it doesn't only involve engineering algorithms in a certain way. It does to a certain extent, but it involves the deployment of those algorithms in a complex social human environment. And so I am really worried about the alignment problem when you think about the cyborg. Now, the question is, of course, there's the classical argument that if you would just exchange in a human being more and more of the sensory apparatus we have and the,
right,
the muscles with machine parts, then eventually we would become a machine, right?
Right.
Okay, so is that really true? I think, so if that machine then had sex, and I kind of wonder how you would build that in into machine parts, but let's not go there right now, then would the offspring of that machine look like the machine? No, you would have to start all over again. Okay, the kits of that machine would be biological organisms again, and you'd have to do the replacement all over again. So there are, if you think about it a little more, this whole thought experiment becomes a lot more complicated than people originally think. But let's follow it up and say, okay, we have organic tissue and we can make Neuralink, you know, brain cyborg sort of thing that, you know, again, so I think the technological parts that we have right now will only replace those parts of the brains that are about calculation, computation. And so we don't have to discuss about that. So the brain computes. Of course the brain computes, because the theory of computation is a theory of something humans do. A computer, in Turing's original paper, is a human being doing calculations in the back of a room in an engineering department or in accounting. So we shouldn't be surprised that the brain can compute, but that's not what the brain does in general, and it's not what the brain evolved for. The brain evolved for solving the problem of relevance in particular situations, and the human brain evolved to solve the problem of relevance, to pick out relevant things to us in very, very, very complex, socially, you know, intricate situations. So it is motivated through and through, motivated reasoning. And that's why I always cringe a little bit when people say, okay, the algorithm is thinking or is understanding. You cannot do that if you don't have that kind of motivation. So even if you replace, so how would we build the technology? Even in a cyborg, we can have organic parts, but you'd have to have the brain being organic. And in that way, that would almost, you know, if you have a cyborg that actually is able to build more of itself, okay, that's sort of real science fiction at the moment. But then, of course, you have to rethink what I just said. So I am criticizing what we have right now, AI done completely in an algorithmic frame, also when it's embedded in a robot, which is embedded in a very different sense than an organism is embedded in its environment. And so I'm criticizing what we have right now, but it's fun to speculate. And I am not saying, and that's very important, that it's completely impossible to come up with such an agential technology. I just worry about it because agents, by definition, will not be aligned naturally with what we do. They will be like people, right? People are hard to align, damn it.
Well, yeah. They certainly are. So I'm so curious about how this autopoietic architecture is so important for the whole process of thought or computation. Like, okay, so you're the self-manufacturing thing. You have a specific point of view, and part of what you want to do is to continue existing, right? That sort of grounds your broader structure of motivations, right? But I'm not entirely sure why you so thoroughly reject what you call the pan-computationalist paradigm, the Church-Turing-Deutsch thesis that, you know, anything, any process that's ongoing can be algorithmatized or captured with an algorithm. That was part of your paper I read, but didn't kind of follow all the way through. So could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I already said that the theory of computation, Church and Turing in the 1930s, they write, when they say computer, they mean a person. So this is something a person does, and particularly computation is something a person does by rote. So you do it, you get a bunch of rules, you get a bunch of data, execute the rules on the data. That's what computation in Turing's sense is till today. Then we turn the whole thing around and we build machines on the von Neumann architecture that are modeled on Turing's machine, and then they implement the theory of computation. And then around, you know, people have for a long time been saying, okay, the brain is a computer, the world is a computer, but Konrad Zuse in the 40s in Germany, but they were like mavericks, loners. This idea comes in really big in the 70s and 80s, and it's funny to see how it parallels the arrival of computers in our households. It becomes a familiar item. And if you think back to the scientific revolution, when does it take off? When mechanical clocks are being built in the churches, actually, of the cities, visible in front of the church, and people can see this and think it's the greatest technology humanity has ever built. Nothing will ever be greater, so the universe must be a clock. Today we think, okay, computers are so cool, so the world must be like a computer. Now, there is really nothing to justify that other than another sort of mistake, philosophical mistake that's happening, and that is, of course, you can simulate any physical process using computation. For example, you can make a computer simulation of a waterfall, and then there's the waterfall argument. Does the waterfall implement any sort of computation? The waterfall in nature doesn't. The computation is imputed by us by making a model of it. So the whole content, the semantic content of the model is put into the model by the human agent who made the model. This is a bit intricate, and you have to stop me when I get into too much philosophical babble here. But I mean, the basic difference is that you should not confuse our ability to model things with computer simulations with the statement that the world is literally a computer simulation. It is like mistaking the map for the territory. So basically, we are building really cool maps, computer simulations to predict weather, the climate, all kinds of really, really complicated things. But it's important to keep in mind that those are simulations and the content, the information process, the symbolic content is in the model, not in the physical process that we're modeling. So it comes out, it's not just out there. It comes out of the interactions of the modeler and the model system, okay? And that's very interesting. So that's where pan-computationalism goes wrong. So for example, there are theories now around in biology as well. So there's the crowd that does the free energy principle. There's Mike Levin's work. And they claim that every system, every physical system does some sort of computation, does some sort of inference in the case of the free energy principle. And so this is what philosophers call the reification, or it's also called the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, when you take an abstract model of the world and you suddenly think it's the world. So it's very, very important. And we come back to that point. Have we proven intelligence if the algorithm acts as if it was an intelligent being? I don't think we have it. We have not understood the nature of these systems, because this is what computation is good at, is mimicking, simulating a certain process and making predictions. But it is very bad at this value aspect of living in the world, of coming to know the world, which is really important. So an algorithm, the computer that runs the simulation, doesn't really understand what's going on. It doesn't understand the aim of the simulation. It doesn't understand what the symbols mean. It's a purely automatic procedure, right? And so the semantics really only come in if you're a living being with a motivated reasoning and motivated agency. And this is where the difference between simulating a system and mistaking the simulation for the real system really matters, because we then get ideas that if the world is a simulation, the simulation hypothesis is probably the most extreme outgrowth of that sort of idea. If you believe that the world is a simulation, you start dreaming of manipulating that simulation. And I think the world, that the living world that is out there, is fundamentally not computable, in the sense that it's not predictable. It has a strong sense of emergence. There's new organization in matter. For example, the evolution of consciousness is something we can talk about later on, but it's something where the rules change in a way that's hard, really hard to predict. And it's not just about computation. And we cannot understand these phenomena at all if we think everything is computation. So I'm sorry, that was a bit of a longer answer than you probably had hoped for. But I tried to pack a lot of goodies into that package.
We're looking for 10 words or fewer.
So as a futurist, I get into this question of where does the future come from all the time?
Right.
Yeah. That's exactly what you're talking about here. I really would like an answer. Where does it come from?
So the future, where does it go? The future comes out of the present. That's quite clear. So I like to think about this in terms of the Laplace's demon. You know, the Pierre-Simon Laplace had this demon that would know everything about the world and could predict everything that would happen in the future and also post-dict everything that happened in the past. But of course, this demon had to be something that's outside the universe, because how can you know everything that's in the universe if you're not actually outside it? Because then you're part of the universe and you would have to know everything about yourself, and you get into all kinds of logical complications. So there's complications there. But I think this pan-computationalized worldview gets the demon back in through the back door. Of course, we have things like the decision problem that say not everything is computable in the age of the universe and blah, blah, blah. But in the end, the demon isn't bounded by the age of the universe or the resources in the universe, because it's not part of the universe. So if you think everything is computation in the universe, then you couldn't know what happens in the future because of computational complexity. But the demon would know, because it wouldn't be restricted by NP completeness, for example. Okay. And so you get, through computationalism, you get this determined future in through the back door. And I think it's reasonable to think about the universe as being deterministic in the sense that every effect has a cause. But I think, and I hope you're happy to hear this as a futurist, that the future is radically open. And that is exactly because there is more to the universe than just computation. And it usually involves a kind of emergence that we call organizational emergence, where new rules of new organizations of matter arise that actually change the rules of how the universe works. And I think that's how you should think about the origin of life. But that's also how we can think about the evolution of consciousness, that we get actually processes that are just physics and chemistry. There's no magic here, but they get to interact in new ways. So we get new rules. Think about evolution that happens the first time a cell arises, then we get the rules of evolution. But the rules of evolution, they don't contradict any of the physics, but you can't predict them by doing quantum physics. Okay, you can simulate the whole universe maybe, but you wouldn't understand what evolution is from that. Okay, so you get actually new rules. And that means the future is radically open. Stuart Kaufman has this idea of the adjacent possible, that the space possibilities that the universe can enter at every moment in time is radically emergent. Okay, it's different every moment in time. And I really like that. So the future is radically open, and we need to be ready for expecting the unexpected. And I think this idea of pan-computationalism gives you an illusion of control that you don't really have. It shuts this unexpected, this radically unknown future out. And for me, this is a very claustrophobic view of the world. I like my future open and a little unpredictable.
But I want to talk a little bit more about the mimicry piece, because that is an objection that's been brought up to, you know, AI safetyists and doomers of various stripes. And in my experience, they usually just bite the bullet and say, okay, fine, it's a simulation. It's emulating, not actually doing it. That doesn't change the fact that you lost the chess game. And in principle, I don't see, I mean, I suspect you just say it's a small world, and maybe that's the nail in the coffin, but it's not clear to me why that emulation couldn't scale up to being, you know, to amounting to a greater than human intelligence. Like, okay, so it's not doing real thought, but if it can see more branches in the tree than I can, I don't know why it couldn't maneuver the world into a configuration it wants that might be counter to the configuration of the world that I want. Like, why would that not get all the way up?
I have two things to say to that. First of all, when you deploy these algorithms in the real world in an agential system full of human agents, it becomes a large world problem immediately. These algorithms are in the world, okay? And they have real world consequences. So that's one thing. The other thing is, of course, that there is a huge danger that in what we're doing right now. So let me explain that in two stages. The first is, why are we so impressed by these algorithms? They do things we have never evolved to do, okay? So our brain is famously bad at keeping more than, it's not exactly 7 items of short-term memory, but it's not a lot. And also, we're extremely bad at seeing higher level correlations and patterns. So if something is high dimensional, this is the trick that a billion parameter LLM pulls off, right? So it sees high dimensional correlations that we can't see, and it can keep billions of pieces of data in memory at the same time. So we are absolutely befuddled what it can do because of that, because it's way beyond human capability already. I mean, there is no doubt about that. I mean, my memory, I just turned 50, is not even at 7 items, short-term memory, right? So there is no doubt we don't have to discuss about superhuman capabilities there. But then when we say superhuman intelligence, what do we mean? And again, I use this term intelligence because I'm a biologist, I can do this, as in, you know, the ability to choose the right kind of action in a situation that may be ambiguous, that may require reframing, that may involve all kinds of motivated reasoning, may involve common sense that you need, what is habitual, what is usual in your context, a context that the machine will never have. So in that sense, these systems that we're building right now in this algorithmic context, again, I want to stress that, they are handicapped in several ways. So first of all, they cannot do the motivated reasoning kind of stuff. They cannot do the reframing. And so I don't think, and this is the final sentence of the How Organisms Come to Know the World paper, it won't be Skynet, it will be Facebook that will be our downfall. By now, it's a few years past, I would say it's TikTok. So again, when you employ these algorithms in the real world, they become a large world problem, really complex. And I think the real danger here, the doomer, so we're on a trajectory that is pretty doomy already. And I think at the moment, with the business model we have with AI, it's just going to accelerate tendencies we already have instead of actually helping us. I do believe there are many good applications for AI in the energy mix we need. It could calculate that much better for us. So these are the kind of problems that require having all these data items in memory, right? So we should use AI, which maybe should be called IA, intelligence augmentation. We should use it as a tool to solve such wicked problems. Okay, but what we're going to do is we're going to get increasingly tempted to give agency away. So people are saying, okay, isn't that just like a pocket calculator? No, because doing long division was nothing but calculation. Okay, it was rote calculation already. So the pocket calculator, these machines replaced a completely rule-based activity. But what we're doing now, creating AI, are letting AI choose our music, our preferences. We are giving our agency away to an algorithm that ultimately, and I think we can say that with certainty, has none. And I don't see any way in which the current algorithmic generation of AI is gonna develop that sort of agency that would, you know, make it wanna take over the world. That's why there will be no Skynet. Why would it do that? And then one last thing maybe about the paperclip kind of analogy is, I think the paperclip example just fundamentally ignores the complexity and the energy-driven nature of far from equilibrium thermodynamics. The paperclip machine will not take over the world, okay? It'll very soon hit some limits in the more complex environment it's deployed in. And it will cause all kinds of shenanigans that will make it break down long before the whole world has been turned into paperclips. So I think the dangers that AI is posing right now come from the way it's deployed, mostly, not its nature itself, that it will develop the urge to take over the world. Why would it do that? It has no urges. It will not have any urges. And why would you want to do that anyway? It's a lot of responsibility. So I think AI is not going to take over the world that way. Instead, we need to pay a lot more attention on how AI is deployed. And I like Joanna Bryson is an AI ethicist, and she always says, the first question we should ask when you develop AI is why? And Sora was a perfect example of that. Sora is an application of AI where I look at it and I wonder, why would anyone need this? It will just lead to lots of people getting addicted and completely escaping into a virtual world when we need people to be here in the real world. We are entering a time of really big crises and we need to be here, solve our problems in the real world. And if you believe, like Dave Chalmers said, that virtual reality is just like real reality, then I can tell you what the difference is. It's very simple. Real reality is what kills you when you ignore it. Okay?
Yeah. Okay, so, you heard it here first. The old paper.
We now have a definition of reality. It'll kill you if you're not paying attention. So,
are you enjoying this episode of the Futurati podcast? If so, please like it, give the show a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and share it with your friends. By far, the best way to help us grow is to spread the word on social media, which will expose our content to more people and help us continue to bring you interviews with world-leading experts in AI, quantum computing, cryptocurrencies, and so much more. Thank you in advance.
What, like, with respect to the intrinsic motivations of a living entity, like, why would a cost function not be enough, right? So the basic idea of the paperclip thing is that it's rewarded by the production of paperclips, right? It does not see taking over the world as a terminal goal as such. It's more just that if it can access more resources, it can make more of these things, right? So why is that cost function not enough for you to eventually get agency at all? It's not really clear.
Yeah, because it's not something that the paperclip optimizer evolved. It's something that was given to it and then went out of hand, right? So the programmer put that function into the algorithm initially, and the algorithm doesn't have, that's a nice example of how an algorithm doesn't have agency. If it had agency, it would be able to judge whether its actions were still useful or not. And this mindless production of paperclips is a clear indication of a lack of agency. Okay, so
Can't you have that with like invasive species as well? Like can't you have something or the ant circles where they just run around? Like even in a biological organism, you could have an adaptation execute in a way that's no longer productive. And I mean, I don't see reframing on the part of ants or these like lower organisms. So why does that not rule them out as agents?
So if you have a fire ant invasion, it's a wave-like phenomenon and it happens very quickly. So you have those ants just destroying everything in their environment. And then the colony will collapse, of course, because it destroys its own substrates. And this would happen very quickly with a paperclip or optimizer too, because the world is a very complex place. And if you're fixed on one target, if you shake the local ecosystem massively out of balance, you will suffer the consequences of that immediately and long before you have turned the whole world into paperclips. It's a bit of a strange idea that this process could go on after it has already reaped massive destruction. So here's the point. Okay, so I don't think this would turn the whole world into paperclips, but it... So I don't think it's the machine that's to blame here, okay? So if we have something like that happening, it's the person that's to blame. Think about the weapons, potential weapons applications of AI, driving self-driving cars, more, you know, maybe less controversial. So we have two problems there. First of all, the self-driving car, of course, moves around in a large world. So a lot of the problems it will encounter will need, to reckon with ambiguity and with reframing, which it can't do. So that's a problem. So, but that's, you know, so does the self-driving car have agency? No, because its purpose was built into it by an engineer. And that's then also the problem of responsibility. When the self-driving car crashes, which it may be, it will be a much better driver than a human driver, but once it crashes, who's responsible, right? That's a huge problem. And that problem only arises because there is no one home. There is no agency in a software agent like that, because ultimately agency, in my biologically motivated view, requires you to evolve your own aims and purposes. And that is not the case with any AI. Ultimately, the task, the motivation is given, even if it's very indirect, unsupervised learning, all of that. Of course, we don't give it, so it has a range of target functions maybe also, but ultimately, the target functions are always coming from the outside and they're provided by an agent, by a living agent, you know, and you there's no way around this. So the algorithm can then develop subsets, you know, of targets functions or decide between different target functions. But again, it needs a rule-based procedure to decide between those. So to summarize it maybe simply is that the algorithm in that sense cannot make its own rules, but a living organism is like an algorithm that not only builds its own code, writes its own code, but builds its own hardware. Yeah. So, and that hardware interacts with the environment, with the large world, learns how to pick out relevant features. And that's the process of evolution. And So I think that's hugely underestimated. A lot of AI researchers poo-poo evolution as being slow and inefficient. But you know what? Evolved systems, they are adjusted to their environment. And not only that, but they are anti-fragile. They're not just robust like technology is. They don't just survive challenges, but they learn from every challenge they encounter. They get stronger. Well, you know, up to a certain degree, not everything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But you see what I mean. I mean, there's a completely different kind of system, an evolving system like that. And it has the capability of meeting with the unexpected future much more robustly than what we've built. Again, so far, I always say so far, the technology so far, I don't know what we're going to develop in the future. But the kind of technologies we have so far are not yet anywhere near tackling these kind of problems, is what I would say. So I really, my fear for AI in the future, I am not a doomer at all. I'm on the fence. I am worried that AI is going to have more negative consequences than positive ones. But all of these worries have to do with how AI is deployed, with the business model. Frankly, I am not very happy with the business model that's employed right now. But I think open source will do a lot of good there. And, you know, we can discuss about all of that. But the main thing here is, we don't want to get into politics. The main thing here is, philosophically, the problems that come out of AI are, in the end, always human problems. It's our choice how to deploy it. It's our choice how to design it. I love Dan Dennett's quote. He says, you know, we put people in prison for faking money, and now we think faking people is a good thing. So here's the question, why again? I mean, why do we construct machines that act as if they're humans without labeling as such? We have to talk about design. The alignment problem is all about algorithm design and policy. How do you deploy these things? And again, I think this IA idea of intelligence augmentation, we have to see it as a sophisticated tool, you know, that we should use to increase our own intelligence, because our intelligence is not the same as that, what we call artificial intelligence. It's fundamentally not the same phenomenon, not the same concept. And people discussed in the 50s already whether it was a good thing to call AI AI, and certainly it wasn't, in my opinion.
I'm curious about whether or not you think there's any potential in evolutionary algorithms to generate these sorts of autopoietic systems. Yeah. Because, you know, as you were talking about the intrinsic perspective, seeing from the eyes of a biological agent, it has skin in the game in a much more existential sense than, you know, even the most sophisticated algorithms do. But those motivations were baked into it by evolution, presumably. It's like the organisms that didn't care about continuing to survive didn't, and didn't pass on their genes, right? But it's like the original agency didn't come from an agent. So I why would a big enough open world kind of simulated environment where these organisms were starting to evolve, like, couldn't something like that give rise to the same sort of phenomenon? And I mean, wouldn't that have implications for the substrate independence as well?
I'm really enjoying your questions, by the way. It's fantastic. So the problem here is, I think this is all connected to this problem of embodiment that I mentioned before, which is really important and underestimated by a lot of people. So you can build an algorithm that is recursive in the sense of reproducing its code, but not in a static way. So it can rewrite itself and continue to be itself by propagating that way. You can use lambda calculus, something like that, for that, metaprogramming, whatever you want. So, but that's still happening within a given, programming language environment and computational environment. So what you really need is a different kind of embedding in the environment. To get biological evolution, you need agency that is directly connected to the environment. You need the software and the hardware to be combined, like I said before. So without that, you don't get this direct experience of the world that organisms have. And of course, also, you need to be able to not just change your hardware, but produce your hardware from the software, right? And so what you get then is more than just recursion, more than just feedback. You get this constructive interaction. And I use a word that will not be very popular here. It's a dialectic, okay? Because it's two things that interact that build each other. And this doesn't mean I'm a Marxist or I have read too much Hegel. It just
Hegelian.
Trying to distinguish a simple process where two processes interact by feedback. They're feeding back on each other, but if you separate them, they still exist. And the organism, the self-manufacturing architecture of the organism, which is co-generation of different. So these processes, they depend on each other in a way that is not just recursive like an algorithm, but it's impredicative. Like a mathematician would say, a bunch of definitions can depend, all depend on each other. And then you have a logical paradox, right? So in the same sense, all these processes, they really depend on each other's existence. So if you take one away, then the others can't exist. And this makes the origin of life such a wicked problem to study, because you need to get all of this happening at one, you know, it's a really unlikely event, I think, in the end, relatively, but the universe is very large, so it happened anyway. But then the fun thing is that once life is there, of course, it has the self-propagating property. So it basically makes its very unlikely state suddenly very likely. And that opens up, and this is the other part of the work that I'm doing when I'm not working on AI. So that gives you open evolution, open-ended evolution, in a sense that that we talked about before, that you get more than just computation. So if you would consider the whole of evolution just as one big simulation and have algorithms compete with each other, you would not be able to reproduce that embedded immediacy. So being that kind of embedded physical system is necessary to get open evolution. And you don't get it in evolutionary simulations. And this is a problem in artificial life. It's hit a ceiling. It's been in an ice age for a long time because it exactly hit a certain ceiling of complexity that you could get from evolutionary simulations. And people are still wondering. And I think this is one of the most important ingredients why we hit the ceiling, is because you've got to get your hands dirty. You got to get out into the real world to have open-ended evolution. And this is stuff that's really not well worked out yet, and that people should work on more and pay more attention to. But all of these ideas that I present here are still at a very early stage. So we need to go and work them out in a very scientifically rigorous way. But the problem is, if we consider everything just computation, if you have this computational approach, computationalist approach or worldview, then we don't even see these problems as problems, right? Because everything can just be simulated in a computer, yeah? And it sort of shuts the door to all kinds of interesting avenues of investigation into what evolution is, what life is, and in the end, what intelligence is and creativity and the meaning of the world for us humans.
Fascinating stuff. So what do you see as the major productive areas of research going forward? I mean, if you could clone yourself... What are the big problems? I mean, the reason I asked is because I don't know if I'm actually going to do it or not, but I was in talks to write a book about artificial general intelligence, and I wanted to explore some of these exact issues. I actually have some philosophy of biology books over there that I haven't had a chance to crack open yet, but I'm sort of interested in like what a person might get into to better understand these things, and you know where a research effort would be best aimed to really like get clear on these foundational ideas like intelligence, consciousness, volition, and aliveness in particular. Are the big four in my view.
Yeah, so if you could give birth to a robotic version of yourself.
If you find you in an LLM.
Okay, yeah, that's a scary thought, man. So I think, again, this may be a bit disappointing, but with AGI, I really think we should first ask the question, why would we want that, right? So I think these AI tools are best deployed as tools, as I said before. And then the question is, what kind of tool would an AGI be like in this very strong sense that I'm thinking about general intelligence here, right? And the point is, just like other people shouldn't be tools, that thing wouldn't be a tool either anymore, right? So do we really, you know, I mean, get a cat. You know, then you have a non-aligned general intelligence in your house. And then tell me again, why would you want a machine that acts like a cat, right? You know what I mean. It would also do all kinds of other useful stuff the cats don't do. But this is a question that bugs me. So I think if I could put on my philosopher hat here for a second, I would say, I think the field of AI should first, so this is maybe my little, we should have a break moment here. If we talk about AGI, we should really have a sit down and think about these concepts really hard for a while. And I don't believe in these pauses in investigation. This is just not something our current society and business models can do. But I think it would be good if some people would have this discussion and have this reflection, and I don't see it. So this is one of the things that made me diverge from the topic of evolution and what I'm supposed to study in my grad and write about this. And I'm trying to get heard by saying we need to inject those discussions into the debate about AGI and AI in general right now, because we need to understand what we're talking about and where we're not talking about the same things. So I think it's very important to do that. I don't know how you would do that in the current environment and business model and general frenzy to develop new things based on the technology we already have. How you would implement such a stop, I don't know. And that, frankly, worries me. But I think that's much more a problem of policy and sociology and complex interactions between humans and machines. Interface, not just interface design, but you know, the deployment of these tools in society, than of pure AI research. So where would I want to see algorithmic AI go? I think these tools are amazing. I would want to see them deployed. And as I said, you know, calculating energy mixes, making things efficient that are wasteful and dangerous at the moment, and so on and so forth. So we should definitely use them for these kind of things. And I think the tools that we have right now are pretty good at that. So I think in terms of AI research, I'm not an AI researcher. I do think that the question of how symbolic AI and connectionist AI would work together is very fascinating. I'm a little more pessimistic than most about that. So I think a new ice age is coming, and there will be a plateau definitely at some point that's being hit in the current mode of research.
Do you need a dynamic and knowledgeable speaker for an event? Thomas Fry and me, Trent Fowler, are both seasoned keynote speakers, able to converse on a wide array of topics to audiences of all sizes and skill levels. Go to the contact page at futuratipodcast.com to book Thomas or myself today, and let us apply our years of experience in public speaking to make your event a smashing success.
Are there questions in the philosophy of biology that you think redound on this topic ultimately?
I mean, so I should say that what I do here as a biologist and as someone who's interested in the philosophy of biology is very fringe. So very few people in active research in biology think about life, funnily enough, as a phenomenon, right? And are just more looking into figuring out the detail of the mechanisms of how different living processes work, which is very important and valuable also in terms of health and all that. So it has very important consequences. But we have lost a bit of the forest for the trees there. And the same happens in the philosophy of biology. So the people that I read and that my work is based on are usually people who are not in the mainstream of their fields, even though some of them, like Stuart Kaufman and Terence Deacon, have reached some level of recognition. So I think we need a rethink, not just in AI research, but in biology itself and in the philosophy of biology, that takes such fundamental questions serious again, because we are at the moment, my background is in systems biology, we are at a unique moment where we can tackle these things in a scientifically rigorous way now. So before these questions came out, they were always very, very speculative. But I want to say again here, this is still not empirically proven, most of it. But it's now the moment where we can access, means, experimental means, technological means. We could use AI, for example, to investigate these things as biologists. And I think we should take that moment, not just to drive new technology, we're good at that, but to sit back and reflect, why this question? Why are we doing what we're doing? And then also to reflect on the concepts that we're using, because I think this has come out of our discussion here very well. So if I talk about general intelligence, if somebody in AI research, it's very different. Creativity, thinking, understanding, all of these things mean an agent. The software agent is something that always kills me. It is no agent. It has no agency by definition. It has a set of targets that it can choose from, maybe. So that makes it autonomous. But it's not autonomous in the sense that a living organism, I mean, it's basically, it's a limited metaphor, but maybe it helps. So you have a thermostat, and, you know, what sets the thermostat? Okay, so the living being is a thermostat that sets itself, its target itself. It doesn't just regulate itself to the target temperature, but it decides what temperature it wants. And I think that is something that is interesting also for technology development, but we here have to ask ourselves really, really hard, is this what we want to develop? Because that, like your cat, will not be aligned with you.
Like John Searle would agree. Well, excellent. That's very fascinating. We could go on for a lot longer, but I really appreciate your perspective here. And it's something that I will be investigating in the future as I think through this stuff as well. Just for my part, as I said at the top of the show, I've long suspected that perspectives from the philosophy of biology would be very important here. And just figuring out, what does it mean to be a living thing? How is that implicated in concepts around agency? How do you induce fresh concepts of these things from the facts that we have? And I ultimately agree with you that I think it's time to begin asking those foundational questions anew, because if we don't get it right, like if the doomers are correct, then we're in a lot of trouble. And if they're wrong, then we're also in a lot of trouble, albeit perhaps not existential trouble. We could end up crippling this promising technology. So I really appreciate it. And I wish you the best of luck in pursuing these lines of inquiry.
Thanks a lot. The future will always be different than we think. And I've been trying to get these ideas heard. So thanks a lot for inviting me and having this chat.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Very enlightening. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Dr. Yeager.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.